Our first speaker today probably needs no introduction, but of course I'm going to do it anyway. He's a professor of English at the University of Toronto. He has written books on Mary Leeper. He's written books on Edith Sitwell. He's written books on Graham Greene, including that superb collection of his letters. He's written books of poetry, one of them award-winning. And of course, last year he published Russian Roulette, or the North American version is called The Unquiet Englishman. He is quite simply the leading Greene scholar, no pun intended, in the entire world. So this morning's talk is by Professor Richard Greene.
Thank you, Mike. That's a wonderful introduction. I wish I deserved all that praise. I feel like I have been incredibly lucky in the course of writing the biography, and indeed in all my work on Graham Greene. I look at the title for this talk, concocted many months ago, at a time when I had no idea what I wanted to say. Now I do know what I want to say. In the main part of this talk, I would like to speak to some important questions posed by reviewers of the book, and more broadly, I want to consider the ethics of how we tell stories. But first, I want to say an impassioned thank you. Before I get maudlin, I would like to play a television advertisement that you may recall from long ago. If I can make this go.
I walked out of it on my own. I sold around without anyone else. Oh dear, oh dear. I wander lonely as a cloud. Mountains on high or vales and hill.
Only I can do this because he prefers the poet of the beard.
Oops. No. Let's see if I can make this move. Nine. No. Paul, I may need some assistance. If we can move to the next slide, it'll all go with incredible smoothness. Paul has rescued many a lecture. Thank you. There is the solitary poet, walking in the splendors of nature, inspired by trees and waterfalls, and of course, a good beer. And then he writes the immortal poem. And so it may be for the romantic poet, but it is not that way for most writers, and in particular, regardless of the amount of beer consumed, and it is considerable, you cannot write a book about Graham Greene in solitude. I can assure you that I did not. I had an enormous amount of help, mainly from people who come here to this festival that has become such an important part of our lives. For many years, our dear friend Caroline Bourget, a patron and very active supporter of this festival, made herself available to me for wide-ranging interviews and was willing to share letters and photographs in her possession. In fact, whole areas of Graham Greene's life would be much more obscure without her recollections of him in the Clapham Common House, in the company of his parents and siblings, in his flat in Albany, on the ranch in Alberta, his role as a father and grandfather. and then his closing months in Switzerland. She spoke about some raw topics. As one might expect, she was not an admirer of Catherine Walston, whom she regarded as a bad influence on her father in the 1940s and 50s, making him short-tempered and hard to get along with. She shared her experience of the loss of her first child, Richard, in 1962. As you may recall from the book, he was born with a heart defect and did not survive surgery to correct it. I was not sure whether referring to her lost son in the book constituted an invasion of privacy, but no, she felt strongly that the story should be included as memorial to him. I came to regard Caroline as a great friend and will miss her very much, as we all will. So too, I was profoundly helped over the years by Frances Green, who, despite a distaste for interviews, actually provided a wealth of information. I particularly valued his giving me freedom to follow the evidence. According to our quotation agreement, he, as literary executor, had the right to see the final manuscript and make observations, and I agreed to give them consideration on a good faith basis, which is quite a different thing from, say, a veto over content. The decisions rested finally with me, so it's all my fault. I sent him the manuscript before publication and heard nothing. My initial fear was that I had gone much too far for his taste in discussing sex and tax dodging, and that he was so upset that he chose not to say anything. I was wrong. When it was in print, he told me of his amazed delight in reading it. The memory I take away from all this is of thoroughly handsome treatment from Caroline, Francis, Anne, Andrew, and Jonathan, and many of their cousins. There are others, too, absent friends who made a great impact on the book, notably David Pierce, who as director ran this festival with infinite whimsy and panache. I am particularly honored that the talk I'm giving now has been established in his memory. On a personal note, David was a constant help to me. You will notice that in my account of Graham Greene's early life, many facts about the school and the chronology of his suicidal flight to the common are drawn directly from David's research, and I relied on an article of his in my treatment of Stamboul Train. So too with other friends of the festival, notably Jeremy Lewis and Bernard Diedrich. There were times when I was constantly applying to both of these experts for information that only they possess. Bernard welcomed me to his home in Haiti and very kindly allowed me to quote freely from anything he had written, not just his memoir of Graham, but his histories of Haiti and Central America, and to make use of his photographs. As a journalist and writer, his intellectual property was his livelihood, and so I was touched by his generosity. Broadly speaking, I owe a debt to scholars who went before me. It is no secret that I had problems with the works of earlier biographers. In the writing of my book, I reached for those of Norman Sherry and Michael Sheldon about once a month to check a fact or to make sure that I had not missed something of importance. And once the manuscript was finished, I read through again to make sure I had not botched things that they handled well. Why so little use of those works? I decided early on that I wanted my work not to be a conversation with earlier biographers, but with the primary evidence and with contemporary scholarship. I wanted to frame the issues in a new way. But even so, I was helped by their discovery of sources. More broadly, I was moving along certain routes where they had gone first. A person who has attended many festivals could read my book in an amusing way, asking of any chapter, who helped him here? Who from the festival? Almost every chapter is indebted to the work of John Wise and Mike Hill. I could never have found out all the fugitive publications and obscure manuscripts that they found. Whenever I write of cinema, there in the background are the works of Quentin Falk, Neil Sinyard, Brigitte Timmerman, and Judy Adamson. Whenever I write of the publishing scene in Britain, there again is Judy Adamson as biographer of Max Reinhardt, and Jeremy Lewis as historian of the Penguin Press. If you look at my chapter on Liberia, you can see my debt to Tim Butcher, who wrote a book retracing Graham's trek. When I write about Vietnam, I am immersed in the research of Kevin Ruane, who also happens to be the real expert now on Catherine Walston. When I write about the Congo, I'm leaning heavily on Michael Mavis, and of course on the late Michel Lachaud. Christopher Hull knows everything there is to know about Graham Greene in Cuba. Carlos Villar Flor was immensely helpful to me about Leopoldo Duran and Greene's travels in Spain. Dr. Tomas Molnar and Dr. Ramon Rami Porta have been infinitely generous about their research on Graham Greene in Hungary. Pierre Joannon guided me through the mysterious episode of the Mafia in Nice. Although they are not part of the festival community, I need to acknowledge the great help I received from the historian of intelligence, Nigel West, and from the late David Cornwell, that is John le Carré, without whose advice my account of Greene's work in intelligence would have been altogether simple-minded. If I started to list all the historians I pestered about, say, the Cristero War in Mexico, the Mau Mau Uprising, the Dirty War in Argentina, the politics of Panama, and so on, I would be at it all day. I have to stop there and leave many thank yous unsaid. And if you are one of those who helped me and did not get a mention just now, please forgive me. But it does rather underline a point I want to make here about the evolution of Graham Greene's studies. Yes, over a number of years, I dug deeply in the archives, and my book presents new information on a good many topics. I will take that much credit. But at the same time, my book is synthetic. It draws together many strands of research that other people have pursued and tries, with lots of citations, I hope enough, to knit them together. Or, in another sense, it is a snapshot of the state of research into Graham Greene's life and career as a writer. A snapshot that will, in due course, become outdated. Graham Greene's studies is not a one-man show. It is not the romantic poet sipping Heineken. It is a broadly cooperative effort by a good number of people. At many points, my book looks outward or points outward to more in-depth studies of particular subjects that I must treat in summary. Yes, I do get to have my say. I put things together in a form that suits me. I disagree here and there with some favored notions, and undoubtedly expert readers will disagree with me on various points. That is the way of it. This book is the child of discussion and dialogue, much of it having happened here in Berkhamsted. The dialogue continues and will eventually leave behind any particular book arising from it, including my own. That is not at all a bad thing. In fact, it is a really hopeful way of seeing things. We will keep learning about Graham Greene for a long time. Now, I'd like to move sideways into a more technical discussion about scholarship on Graham Greene. In the course of researching and writing the book, I found that certain very different issues forced themselves into the foreground. Or to put it another way, I began to realize that the life of Graham Greene could not be reduced to a single story. Looking back on it all, I wrote in the introduction, as after all, introductions are the last thing you write, this is not one narrative, but several braided together. It looks at the psychological history of a man who was traumatized as an adolescent over questions of loyalty and betrayal, and then suffered a mental illness that brought him to the point of suicide on several occasions. It is the story of a traveler whose restlessness caused him to seek out troubled places where his concerns were politics, poverty, and human rights. It is the story of a man who struggled to believe in God and yet found himself described against his will as a great Catholic writer. It is the story of a private life in which loves and passions ended in one ruin after another, until his sixth decade, when he found constancy and peace in an unconventional relationship. It is a story of politicians, battlefields, and spies. More than anything, it is the story of a novelist mastering his craft and exercising it in a way that changed the lives of millions. This meant that the book is telling five major interlocking stories about Graham Greene's life. I'll see if I can do this properly here. Okay, just a quick abstract. It's the psychological history. There is the story of a traveler and his political involvements in troubled places. There's the story of his religious struggles. There's the story of his personal relationships and sex life. And there's the story of his growth as a writer. There are actually a few more minor storylines, such as his ways of making money and his life specifically in theater and cinema. And maybe I should regard intelligence work as a separate narrative line. I don't want to be too schematic. But insofar as the book dragged me along behind it, and at times it did feel like that, these are the main paths it took. And bear in mind that any event could play a role in two or three or indeed all of these storylines. The book received about 55 reviews. The vast majority positive, some thrillingly so, including one from John Banville that made me impossible to live with for about 2 weeks. I'm still not easy to live with. A couple that I found particularly gratifying were written by people present at this festival, and I am honored by what was said. But having done my bit of bragging, I want to dwell on some of the reviewers' complaints, which often boil down to a preference for one of the big five stories over the others. I will start with a review that caused concern to some people gathered here, the one by Joan Acacella in The New Yorker. It does take a few pokes at me, not unbearable ones, but the real victim was Graham Greene himself. Indeed, as a writer who responded to Acacella in the Commonweal magazine noted, The New Yorker has seldom been just to Graham Greene. Just think of the Liebling review of The Quiet American. In this instance, Acacella was sweepingly dismissive of any discussion of Greene's mental health, of the end of his marriage to Vivian Darrell Browning. Acacella remarks that as an excuse for infidelity, he, quote, summoned his bipolar disorder. She then quotes from a letter from 1948 in which he refers non-specifically to a disease that affects his behavior. She asserts that before this time he had had a number of psychotherapists when in fact he had had only one for 6 months when he was 16. As the book makes clear, there is no evidence that Greene had a diagnosis of manic depression until 1950. When one was made by a distinguished psychiatrist named Eric Strauss, whose patient he remained for a decade. Although not a psychiatrist herself, Acacella feels free then to dismiss that diagnosis. As a matter of due diligence in research, I consulted with several specialists in the field, none of whom could find sufficient grounds to overturn it. Indeed, the self-assured Acacella goes on to claim, the essential point about the manic depressive diagnosis, however, is that Greene accepted it, indeed saw it as key to his personality and his work. This can be the essential point only if the diagnosis was false. I'm going to say that again. This can be the essential point only if the diagnosis was false. If it was accurate, then the diagnosis has enormous consequences for any objective effort to understand its life, and it would make untenable the casual contempt this reviewer shows for Greene's character. Acacella's attitude towards matters of mental health is surprisingly harsh. She refers to the, quote, comic ineptness of the young Graham Greene's repeated attempts at suicide. There's nothing comic about a boy trying to kill himself. The ineptness is nothing to mark, as success would have meant death. And The New Yorker published that. Of course, you will forgive me for lingering over this particular review. Sometimes a little counterpunching is called for. As Andrei Gortzo and others noted on social media, the review is riddled with straightforward errors, which the magazine's vaunted fact-checkers missed. For example, she claims, rather imaginatively, that when Green moved out on his wife Vivian and took his own apartment, she was left, quote, carving dollhouse furniture. Herself a scholar, Vivian collected and wrote about antique dolls' houses and established a private museum dedicated to them. But she did not carve the furniture. My book makes no such claim. To be fair to Occhiella, who might have known something I didn't, I asked Frances Green, who confirms with a hint of scorn that his mother did not carve tiny pieces of furniture. This is something the reviewer invented with the effect of making Vivian appear pathetic. With regard to Brighton Rock, Occhiella refers three times to a character named Hall. There is no such character, but there is one named Hale. In fact, Hale is the first word in the novel, and the misspelling suggests she did not open it to check, nor did the fact checkers. Of the third man, Occhiella writes, the book was actually a byproduct of the film Green had agreed to write, something he produced to get a feel for atmosphere before applying himself to the script. That's what she says. Although Green remembered it this way, the biography, which Occhiella is supposed to have read, cites correspondence with his agent prior to the film contract in which he declares that he will write the story for publication and turn it into a script only if the producers approve. Contrary to her assertion, the script was the byproduct of the novel. She reserves some of her strangest observations for The Quiet American. For a time, Green divided his books into novels and entertainments. Occhiella places The Quiet American among the entertainments, when it was for Green one of his most important novels. She goes on to describe the first film made from it as wonderful. This film actually reversed the plot, representing Fowler as tricked by communists and Pyle as the hero of the piece. For Green, it was an absolute betrayal of the book and is now seen as a mere relic of Cold War propaganda. I could continue in this vein, but the point is made. Occhiella did little more than skim the book she was assigned for review. Otherwise, she could not have made all these errors. To borrow one of Occhiella's phrases, that's a lot. She may have helped me to sell books, and the publisher was crazy to get any notice in the New Yorker, but I think she did some harm to the reputation of an important author. I will say that some other more fair-minded reviewers thought that by emphasizing Green's bipolar illness, I was letting him off the hook for some frightful behavior. I could understand this reaction, even as it led to me being called decent and wholesome in the TLS. And who wants to be called decent and wholesome? Such a characterization made me briefly want to jump off a wharf. But in fact, I was not just looking on the bright side, as a headline put it. I was being consistent. If Graham Greene was correctly diagnosed with bipolar illness, we have to accept that the disease has features. It can include, at certain points, an accelerated sex drive and excessive irritability. No secret about that, it's in all the literature. The disease was at its worst, he said, in the 1950s. But even late in his life, Yvonne Cloetta saw that he would be absorbed in what she called violent urges for a time, only to emerge and curse himself for what he had said or done. It sounds to me like he was in the grip of something that overwhelmed him, and that was at a time when the disease had moderated. Often enough, journalists have referred to his illness as though it made him into a jolly rogue. It is an illness that causes enormous hardship for sufferers and for those around them. Failure to grasp this is a kind of bigotry. What is now called ableism. There's always a new ism, but this one's worth thinking about. I am actually agnostic about the culpability of Graham Greene in certain matters, as I don't know how far his mood disorder was driving him and how far he was acting out of selfishness and arrogance. Given the evidence available to us, I am not in a position to draw that line, and I don't think anyone else can do it legitimately either. However, we cannot even begin to think about the problem until we admit that mental illness matters and that it matters in the life of Graham Greene. Reviewers disagreed about how much sex is enough. I think they must be lonesome and living vicariously. And again, this belongs to one of the five narratives I outlined a few minutes ago. Certainly, the book documents a great deal of sexual activity, including, for the first time in a biography, a description of Greene's sexual initiation, which was with a young prostitute in a hotel near Leicester Square. And the book brings forward the identities of some girlfriends not referred to in earlier biographies. There's the person referred to in correspondence of the late 1940s by the name Claudette Mond. As it turns out, this was a misspelling on Greene's part, and you may have noticed that André Gorzo has found out who that most likely was, the French literary critic Claude-Edmond Magny. A little later, it is evident that Greene was involved with a French writer named Allegra Saunders. Following up on information contained in John and Mike's bibliography, I drew a portrait of Mircea Rahiner, later Harrison, who had spent time capturing tigers and rhinoceroses for European zoos. She and Greene had an affair in Bangkok in 1954. Moreover, the book is very emphatic about how Greene was involved with prostitutes over many years. Perhaps what some reviewers were longing for, she and Greene had an affair in Bangkok in 1954. Moreover, the book is very emphatic about how Greene was involved with prostitutes over many years. Perhaps what some reviewers were longing for was detail about specific sexual acts, positions, the state of the bedsheets, and the like. There comes a point, however, when the accumulation of sexual detail, in excess of what is needed to support an argument or illustrate a point, becomes voyeuristic. I'm not saying here there should be no sex described in the biography, not that at all. I do cite Jocelyn Rickard's story of having sex with Greene in a train carriage from Southend. She herself asked his permission to write of such things in her memoir, and he said, "I am no more ashamed of our affair than you are." I am not saying that all such things should be excluded, but I do think they should be proportionate to the case you are making. Many people here will have followed the scandal concerning Blake Bailey's biography of Philip Roth. As you will recall, W.W. Norton, also my publisher in the United States, so that's their version there, dropped Bailey's book once accusations were made against him in the press of grooming minors for sex and of rape against an adult woman. I've not met Bailey. I've never met the guy. These are very weighty charges. The book itself rather celebrates Roth as a sexual transgressor, and for all its thorough research, descends fairly often into the wink and nudge, and so, to put it plainly, objectifies or even dehumanizes the women Roth was involved with. Some people would have preferred more sex in my book, but I was anxious to avoid a portrayal of Graham Greene's sexual life as somehow entertaining, even thrilling. I was not going to present him as a sexual good old boy. Even in the Rickard story I spoke of above, a woman is speaking for herself. It is not the talk of men in the locker room. Greene's sexual life was often bleak and joyless, and I trust that that came through in my account. I was particularly grateful to the critic Hannah Joyner, who reviewed my book twice, once in the Open Letters review and then in a YouTube presentation, comparing my book to Bailey's. She strongly disapproved on feminist grounds of what Bailey had done and approved of what I had done. Referring to favorable views is a form of boasting, but I hope you forgive me, as there is an important point to make here. Now, let me go back to the beginning of this talk. For the sake of fun, I played you that Heineken ad. But now I want to ruin the joke by asking the question more seriously. Wordsworth again, thinking deep thoughts. What do we make of the writer as solitary? The genius set apart, the exalted sensibility, the creator nonpareil. I have to make an ethical claim about literary biography. We cannot treat the human beings who come into the story as mere background for the sorrows or even the greatness of the poet or novelist. We cannot dehumanize them. Where relationships exist, we must try as far as possible to render something of both sides. We must not be complicit in the dehumanization of others with whom Green or Roth or whoever was involved. Nor can we tidy that problem up and address the realities only insofar as they inspired a book or even affected the way it was written. Genius does not get to exploit the lives of others. And in our research, we have to keep thinking about the people a writer engaged with, and we have to do justice to them. And that means, as a matter of method, the inclusion of detail about lives and cultures and polities other than those of the writer. And in this, I strongly believe we would be honoring Graham Greene's own commitments as a writer. Some years back, the novelist Zadie Smith made these claims about the Quiet American. And there's two paragraphs of this, but it's really important. I think it's classic commentary. Reading the novel again reinforced my fear of all the piles around the world. They do not mean to hurt us, but they do. Greene's great achievement is to allow a cynic like Fowler to champion the cause of life by insisting on the authenticity of those deaths Pyle considers to be merely symbolic. Fowler is at least idealistic enough to believe that there is not an idea on this earth worth killing for. When Pyle interrogates Fowler as to what, if anything, he believes, he says, "Oh, I'm not a Berkeleyan. I believe my back's against this wall. I believe there's a Sten gun over there." Pyle replies, "I didn't mean that." Greene's work does mean exactly that, Smith continues. The hope he offers us is of the kind that only close observers can give. He defends us with details, and the details fight the good fight against big, featureless, impersonal ideas like piles. Too much time has been spent defending Greene against the taint of journalism. We should think of him instead as the greatest journalist there ever was. If more journalists could report as well as Greene, bringing us the explosion in the square, how long could we retain the stomach to fight the wars we do? The devil is in the details for Greene, but redemption is also there. The accretion of perfectly rendered everyday detail makes us feel human, beats away the statisticians, tolls us back to ourselves. I think Zadie Smith is onto something here. I would set her position against that of, say, Blake Morrison, who had this to say about Russian Roulette and The Guardian. The emphasis on Greene as foreign correspondent and emissary is certainly fresh, but the cost is an excess of information on the internal politics of the countries he visited, not always pertinent to the fiction. To spend more time on the history of Panama in the 1970s, for example, than on Greene's long and complicated affair with Catherine Walston may be a corrective to earlier biographies, but it does little to explain the man and throws more attention on a lesser nonfiction book, Getting to Know the General, than The End of the Affair, his masterpiece. This is not actually exactly an insult, but I think I need to push back against it. First of all, Catherine Walston is mentioned, or letters to her are cited, on almost every page of my book between 1946 and 1960, a run of 150 pages. The chapter on The End of the Affair occurs in the midst of this. Catherine appears frequently in the rest of the book, and it is at the heart of a late chapter in which I make the case that Dr. Fisher of Geneva was in large part a response to her death. It's a crude measure, but let's have a look at the index. In the lower corner. Here is the entry for Panama. See them there? Here is the entry for Catherine Walston. Which is almost exactly twice as long. Okay, so another reviewer was skimming and got it wrong. Oops. As for Panama, Green first went there in 1976 and made repeated visits to various countries in Central America, not just Panama, until he could travel no more. Here he is with Omar Torrijos in a photo I believe should be credited to Bernard Diedrich. Green was absorbed in the politics of the region for a good 15 years. It led him to write a memoir, Getting to Know the General, an unfinished novel called On the Way Back, a completed novel, The Captain and the Enemy, and some major pieces of journalism. So there was no getting around the importance of this particular involvement. Now, Morrison, the Guardian reviewer, is obviously more interested in the aesthetic issues of Green's career and in an essential romantic relationship. He's emphasizing two of the five narratives and downplaying a third. He would include detail if it is, as he says, quote, pertinent to the fiction. That is the basis on which he would choose which details to include. To my mind, this could easily lead to a somewhat reduced vision of Graham Greene and a form of scholarship that has an amoral tendency. This may be counterintuitive, but stay with me. I am convinced that Graham Greene, as a traveler, one who investigated abuses of human rights across the globe, has to be understood against the context of the places where he became involved. And that means accepting complexity and detail. Throughout the writing of the book, I kept thinking of Francis Bacon's remark, "What is truth?" said jesting Pilate, and would not stay for an answer. The object of research related to Graham Greene is not always just to get inside his skin or illuminate his creative acts. Much of the book is dedicated to just these things, and they are terrifically important. But there is more to be considered, other narratives, other storylines. From his youth, Graham Greene traveled in troubled places and compiled detailed accounts of what was happening to neglected peoples. Does that matter? Or are we just reading for the exotic atmospheres, the dank vegetation, the bordellos, and the smoky bars? Do we really need to know whether the Firestone Tire Corporation was engaged in forced labor, i.e. slavery, on its rubber plantations in Liberia? That is the main reason Green went there. What is our responsibility to that fact? What is our responsibility to the situation in Mexico that Graham Greene went to investigate? Do we need to get into the details? He certainly did. And later, what was happening in Malaya, or Vietnam, or Chile, or Paraguay, or Argentina? Do the battles, the hardships, the acts of repression which he documented matter? Does it matter whether he got it right in those places? Does it matter how historians have pressed on with the inquiries in which he was engaged? We must be very careful not to treat the sufferings of millions as the mere backdrop to a single white man's psychodrama. Graham Greene himself would need no convincing on this point. He was especially aware as he grew older that the unhappiness of privileged white people hardly compares to the sorrows of people in the world's poorest countries. In the biography, I draw attention to a burnt-out case, how in a burnt-out case the troubles of query are explicitly compared to a farce or a comedy. Green is presenting it as Shakespeare did, the murder of Gonzago in Hamlet, as a play within a play, to touch the conscience on a particular point. The great tragedy, that of leprosy and mutilation, of poverty and ostracism, goes on around it and makes it seem small. He used precisely the same device in his next novel, The Comedians, to emphasize how the adulteries and jealousies of Brown and Martha and Jones are no more than a comedy compared to the great tragedy of Haiti. One of the reviews I most enjoyed was that in Private Eye, which described the book as not half bad. Nicest thing anyone ever said to me. But it characterized me and my book as woke. This came as a great surprise to my children, who have always regarded me, however lovingly, as part of the problem. And yet I stand my ground. There is no understanding Graham Greene without an understanding of the places he visited and the people with whom he became involved. I had a great deal of fun writing this book, but I have to say that aspects of it were very disturbing. I found myself referring, fairly briefly, to unimaginable horrors. The Holodomor in Ukraine that killed about 4 million. A famine in Vietnam at the end of the Second World that killed 1 million people. 300,000 who died in the Algerian War. People tossed from the back of airplanes in Argentina's dirty war. I became quietly shocked by the sheer body count. It became a slight thing to refer to the death of thousands. It is very much in the spirit of Graham Greene to worry about this. When Fowler is being interviewed by Vigo in The Quiet American about the death of Pyle, he says, "You can rule me out," I said, "I'm not involved." "Not involved," I repeated. It had been an article of my creed. The human condition, being what it was, let them fight, let them love, let them murder. I would not be involved. My fellow journalists called themselves correspondents. I preferred the title of reporter. I wrote what I saw. I took no action. Even an opinion is a kind of action. Fowler hardly believes what he was saying. He is haunted, even at this moment, by the words of Mr. Hang. Sooner or later, one has to take sides if one is to remain human. I don't think we can pass through Greenland and remain indifferent to what we see. It is incumbent on us to act, if only by forming an opinion. One of the less studied works of Graham Greene is The Comedians. And I just, to lighten up, well, I don't know if I am lightening up. This is the Olufsen Hotel on which it's based on, but just after the earthquake. It's about, I don't know if, this is several years after the earthquake. I don't know if it's been repaired. I'm sure it's been cleaned up somewhat. It was still operating when I went there with Bernard. And for those of you who may not have read The Comedians, this provides an almost exact model for what's described in The Comedians. The main character is a hotel owner. In The Comedians, Greene gives a good deal of thought to the usefulness of writing, particularly when confronting as terrible a regime as that of Papa Doc in Haiti. I want to revisit the last paragraph of my chapter on it. As you will recall, the hotel owner, Brown, has been stirred, much as Fowler was in The Quiet American, out of indifference and cynicism to become involved in a struggle. Here's the paragraph. Although Greene hoped that his book would injure the regime, he was under no illusion that it would topple a dictator. Indeed, one theme in the book is whether art can ever bring about political change, as so many of the rebels in the book begin as poets and artists. In the first paragraph, Brown speaks of statues raised in London to politicians who stood for free trade or perhaps the Ashanti War, while to the pigeons, none of it makes any difference. Brown considers what memorial can be raised to Jones and the rebels. He quotes a phrase from the Odes of Horace, "Exige monumentum." Translated, the whole sentence would be, "I have raised a monument more lasting than bronze." At the end of the story, Brown becomes involved, not as a soldier, but as an undertaker, that is, an agent of memory. Auden famously wrote, that poetry makes nothing happen. For Green, however, remembrance is a political act. The revolutionary work of this novel is to remember the obscure dead and name truthfully what killed them. I think that Graham Greene has given us our lead here. Scholarship makes nothing happen, but it makes opinion possible, and it does the work of remembrance. It brings us to an encounter with sorrow that is not our own. That well-worn phrase, life and times, is, as I say in the introduction, the essence of the book. There is no understanding Graham Greene except in the political and cultural contexts of dozens of countries. And in an odd sense, the reverse is also true. We fail to understand something about modern times if we ignore Graham Greene. Here is a single life on which much of the history of a century is written. To put it another way, his life can be a lens through which to see a troubled world, to encounter, as he did, people on the edges, or the periphery, as a modern leader puts it. People on the edges, the poor, the oppressed, the uprooted, the tortured. I like to think that I have engaged in a biography of encounter, attempting not just to see into the eyes of the subject, but through them to a larger world. I think you would have liked that. Thank you. I'm actually blind as a bat. I'm putting my glasses on so that I know who's talking.
Thank you very much. That was absolutely fascinating. And I must apologize, I haven't yet read your biography. But one thing I was struck by, particularly with your very strong ending there, I think I read just before Graham Greene died, he talked about his affinity with liberation theology. And it struck me forcibly in what you were saying that this was really resonating with what Pope Francis has been speaking about recently, about how the Catholic Church has to go out and be a field hospital and go out to the margins. And this is resonant also within Catholic social teaching in general, what people talk about as the Church's best kept secret. Do you have anything to add to Graham Greene's Catholicism and this strong sense of social justice and his compassion for revolutionaries and the forces of the left?
I think that's a really important point. And to recap you, that in the 50s, Graham Greene stopped going to the sacraments because he felt that he could not legitimately receive them because he couldn't reform his life. He's going to be remaining in a state of he was in a bad way and shouldn't receive the sacraments. And so he called it off for the better part of 30 years, and he went back to it when he was older. He was always touch and go, whether he believed or he didn't. You know that tension of, doubt and belief in his thinking, that he could somewhat believe. He could believe at night when he prayed. He could believe by instinct. Intellectually, he couldn't make a lot of sense of Catholic positions. But on the other hand, he felt that atheism was itself too assured, that there had to be some doubt in the unbelief, as he would put it. So that's kind of where he was. However, in his travels throughout the Third World, he did constantly connect, usually with Jesuits, but with others, sometimes Marignol nuns, and that is, he was doing this from early days. I'm not a historian of liberation theology, But he was involved with activist priests from the early 70s. He knew about the, my brain is failing me, that movement of priests in Colombia. There's a name for them, I can't remember. He doesn't refer in his writings to the main liberation theologians. No Gutierrez, no Leonardo Boff. We don't find those names. But he was clearly immersed in that world, and he was so involved with social justice, and it was so tangled up with his travels. And incidentally, that's two of the storylines, right? That I would say that he was de facto, if he was a Catholic, he was a Catholic of liberation theology principles, especially at the end of his life. It's not a simple matter. It did lead him into some messy alliances, because as we now know, Daniel Ortega didn't work out. so anyway, I throw that out there. Is that an answer? I hope, yeah. Yeah.
Hello, Philip Hornbury. Thank you for both fantastic biography,
it's very kind,
which I've read and enjoyed, but also for explaining how you've responded to the challenges of your critics, which I think was really, really interesting. But I do have one area of disquiet with your biography. And if we go to your American title, The Unquiet Englishman, which the obvious reference to The Quiet American, and I'm sure you were also referring to the fantastic book by Dr. K. Redfield Jameson called The Unquiet Mind, which those who haven't read it is all about bipolar disorder. Now, another book by Dr. K. Redfield Jameson, she talks about the artistic influence and bipolar disorder, and mentions the dangers to biographers of doing exactly what you have done, and of causing offence to those who've lost close relatives with bipolar disorder by falsely asserting, doing what you say you haven't done in this instance. Now, 100 years ago, Kenneth Richmond made a false diagnosis on Graham Greene. Do you think possibly you may have fallen into the same
hole? That's a really great question. Let me come at that a couple of ways. The first is that I didn't choose this title. That was the publisher's title. And afterwards, I had a dislike for it because I found that other people had used the same pun, but they were insistent that that was the title for the United States. I am responsible for this title, which was part of a brainstorming session with Russian Roulette, with Little Brown. Having said that, I don't actually diagnose him. I inherit a diagnosis from Eric Strauss, and then I put it before several psychiatrists and a developmental specialist as well. And they could see no obvious reason to overturn it. And that's why I choose that cautious language. I am not in a position to diagnose anybody. But having said that, the disease has features then. And so that's where I'm going. But I think you're awfully important to know, to point out the duty of extreme sensitivity in approaching this stuff, because it's hardly anybody in whose circle someone hasn't been lost or isn't in danger. And I did actually sit down with Kay Redfield Jameson and go over this stuff. And she's quoted in the book. So I did my best to be diligent about it, because it is there as a fact. And if I'm silent about it, that's an error. If I say too much, that's an error.
No, thank you for being so forthright about that. And my point would be just about, like all diagnosis, very much we're in the world where everything is named these days. And bipolar disorder, as a physician, there is very much a spectrum, and I would absolutely agree with everything you say about cyclothymia. I think moving into the areas, more formal areas of bipolar 1 and bipolar 2, it's getting a little bit more dicey, and that's
where
I would challenge.
Oh, you'd be quite right to challenge me, because one of the early readers of the book wanted me to buckle down and to be specific about which kind of, which branches, and that is way above my pay grade. Kay Redfield Jameson did have an opinion on this, but she didn't really feel like having me quote her if she couldn't research the matter. And keep away from it. The other thing is, I'm sorry, I should be near the mic for the recorder. As she was saying to me that manic depression, the old name for bipolar disorder, has been known since the late 19th century. It was studied in France, and going forward in the 50s, the lithium treatment became available. It's quite a long-standing category in mental health, so it has some durability. I'll just throw that out there. I can't speak to the science, as I'm not a scientist. Hey, I know I'm wandering out towards the end of the branch that I'm entitled to stand on, and then, as you say, I should just shut up. Well, you're not saying that, but I'm saying it. I should shut up, because the branch is going to break. Yes, he first refers to himself as manic depressive around 1950, and then it appears in his autobiographical writings, and he speaks broadly of periods that were manic or depressed, and I actually don't use that as a schema for interpreting his life, because I felt really uncomfortable about that. His characterization of, say, the time in which he was writing Travels with My Aunt as a manic phase. Well, maybe. I think you'd really want to be a psychiatrist to do that. But one of the problems with writing a psychiatric biography, a purely psychiatric biography, is that you lose the other narratives. So it's all about the mental health. So what about the aesthetic striving? What about the particulars of the relationships? What about the commitment to social justice and the traveling through the world? What about his religious struggles? And then the other minor storylines that I referred to. So just trying to keep them in tension. One thing that I will say about her biographies is that she has been faulted for a kind of a psychiatric reductionism on Robert Lowell in her last book. This is a very accomplished, she holds a professorship in psychiatry. She is herself actually a psychologist at Johns Hopkins, and you will have seen her in Tom O'Connor's documentary on Graham Greene. She appears in it, and she's written extensively on authorship in light of this illness. Yeah.
If you don't mind, Ben, I'm just aware people want a coffee. Just to say that Richard is here throughout the whole of the festival.
Absolutely.
I'm right in saying. And I'm sure if you want to beard him in his lair, wherever he happens to be at the time, he'll answer further questions in order to try and keep to time, if that's okay. So all I can do at this stage is to thank Richard for his book and to thank him for his presentation. I think that's been absolutely first rate. Thank you very much.